Hello and welcome to episode 137 of the Sea Control Podcast, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm Matthew Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control. And on this week's episode, Naval War College professor Derek Reveron joins me to talk about security cooperation and partnerships between the U.S. military and its foreign counterparts. We talk about how security cooperation works, the challenges involved, and the strategic reasons for doing it in the first place. We'll get started with this eye-opening interview after a brief word about our organization.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Join us today.
And we're back. As I mentioned at the top, I'm here with Professor Derek Reveron of the Naval War College. Derek, thanks very much for being with us on Sea Control today.
Hey, Matt. Great to be here. And just as the standard disclaimer, I'm speaking my own personal views, and I don't represent the Navy, the Naval War College, or the Department of Defense.
That brings back good memories of when I was doing security cooperation for the Air Force, so totally understand. So as is Sea Control tradition, please introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about your background and what were the major things that you did that got you to where you are today.
No, it's a great question, and thanks for posing it so I can think about those sort of things. I have a PhD in public policy analysis from the University of Illinois at Chicago. And the book really represents sort of the fusion of two parts of my professional life. So on the one hand, I've been a Navy reservist for about 27 years now. And in that role, I would say my career has really been marked by the conflicts in the Balkans, Bosnia and Kosovo, Middle East, of course, and Central Asia. And then the other side of my life, which is my academic career that examines U.S. foreign policy and defense strategy. And where the two came together was really while I was serving over at NATO military headquarters during Kosovo in 98-99. And I witnessed how the Supreme Allied Commander is generally Wesley Clark at the time. He was both a military leader, but I would also say in the academic sense, a policy entrepreneur, that he was a senior diplomat working closely with foreign heads of state, the U.S. Secretary of State as well. And when I came back from that, examined others in a similar vein, General Zinni in the late 90s at CENTCOM, and then a little deeper, I got to work with Admiral Crowell a little bit when he was teaching at the Naval Academy and talk to him about his experience at PACOM. And what I learned is combatant commanders are as much policy entrepreneur as warfighter, and they really have to be national security leaders, not just military leaders.
So you said that that's what prompted you to write your book. And obviously, as people have seen either in the blog post or in the description of this, it's called Exporting Security. So tell us a little bit about Exporting Security. What prompted you to write it? You know, you talked a little bit about, you know, your background and why you're interested in this topic, but why specifically write this book? And also, we saw that there is a second edition that came out just last year, updating the version that came out in 2010. So what prompted you not just to write the first version, but to stay involved in following that topic and improving it?
Now, the first edition I wrote during the height of the Iraq War, and it was very clear what the military was doing in a combat zone. But upon further examination, when we started looking at what is the U.S. exit path and strategy, the success was based primarily on building the Iraqi forces to take over for U.S. forces. And I looked more broadly outside of combat zones to see, well, what else is the U.S. military doing? And partly being as a professor, I was able to work with other security cooperation offices, primarily in Latin America and East Africa, and see what they're doing in ways that they're helping other countries address what I call security deficits. The second edition was sort of nice to kind of revisit, because what I found in the first edition is I tilted probably too much to sort of the weak state, failed state, and neglected, ignored, developed states. And so the second edition really sort of takes into account a number of things. One, I got to serve for a year in Afghanistan, working at the main NATO Train and Equip Command for the Afghan Security Forces, where we did industrial scale security cooperation. And then second, really looking at what are the things the U.S. is doing to help developed countries such as Japan deal with its security concerns on China, Saudi Arabia as it relates to Iran, and then European countries as it relates to Russia. So the second edition really tries to take into account sort of all dimensions of how does the U.S. help other countries address their security deficits.
So let's talk about that. What are the ways that the U.S. Addresses security deficits? You know, what are the different levers that they pull, and what are the different methods or TTPs that you end up using to do that kind of mission?
Well, it starts, you know, the simple approach is really through foreign military sales. One of the most important exports, I would say, from the United States are weapons and training. And so if you took a particular example like the C-130, I think more are flying outside the United States on other countries' flags than flying the U.S. flag. That's one way. As a professor deeply involved in the education of foreign military leaders, and so at the Naval War College, we've got about 70 countries that send officers. And these are top performers who often go back to their own services. And I think at any one time in the world, about 15% of the heads of Navy of the world are U.S. Naval War College graduates. So there is a leader development dimension to it in addition to that. And then finally, I would say through exercises where it all comes together. Because coalition warfare is a norm. When I was in Afghanistan, we had 50 countries that we were working with. Interoperability is key. And you get interoperability by having common platforms. So back to the defense exports, you get common training and doctrine through education in our training schools that international participants attend. And then you practice that through exercises.
So you've talked a little bit about some of the reasons also then embedded, not just how we do it, but also why we do it. But I want you to expand on that a little bit more, because it's an interesting sort of combination of, you know, interoperability, like you mentioned, more operational kinds of things. But you also talk about some of the strategic reasons why doing this kind of a mission and doing security cooperation is important. So walk us through some of those things. What does the U.S. get out of a security cooperation arrangement?
So, yeah, right. So there's two sides of it. So there is sort of like, what do we get out of it? But I would also say sort of American generosity and political culture help explain a lot. You know, there was an officer from Chad who sort of captured, you know, on the political culture side, if your neighbor's house is burning, of course you should go put it out so it doesn't jump to your own house. But there is, I think, an effort for the U.S. to help other countries just be better, because if they are better and stronger in dealing with their own security challenges, then the U.S. will not have to intervene. Additionally, in combat zones, for the U.S. to redeploy, it needs to hand off the security situation to some military. And I think in the Balkans, we look to sort of NATO do those missions, and we still have KFOR running in Kosovo. In Iraq and Afghanistan, it was really about handing over to the Afghans and the Iraqis. But I think the overall goal, I think, is just to stabilize that region. So, for example, in South Korea, which since North Korea is in the news daily now, you know, the U.S., this is probably one of the great security cooperation success stories, because the Koreans were able to take U.S. training, equipment, and develop a very capable military. And so now you have about a 700,000 South Korean force supported by a 30,000 U.S. force.
Now, you also mentioned in there, you know, so that's more on the operational side, but you also mentioned some of the kind of the more economic aspects of these relationships and what security, what cooperation can do for the defense industry, or not just the industry itself, but the industrial base that is sort of the, you know, underpins our security advantages. So I was wondering if you could walk us through some of kind of the political economy aspects of this too.
Yeah, so from a U.S. sort of domestic perspective, that, you know, defense weapons are a huge export for the United States. And so that has multiple aspects, employs Americans, keep lines open for aircraft, for example. And it also has the effect of lowering costs. And so can you imagine the price of what an F-35 would be if we didn't have international partners also buying into that system and bringing that cost down? I haven't been able to confirm it, but informally someone told me the P-8, for example, because it's an international platform as well, that it's lowered the cost about 10% to U.S. purchases of this. And then, you know, I think on the other end of why security even matters is your big boss, Admiral Stavridis, Dean of the Fletcher School. You know, he at one point said something when he was a Southcom commander that money is a coward. So in countries that lack security, then they're not going to get investment, they're not going to get the development, and they won't be good trading partners, within their region and with the United States and the world.
And so those are some of the benefits, but what are some of the drawbacks and the pushback that is against, you know, sort of the security cooperation mission? Because this has been my experience working with the Air Force, and of course, this does not represent the views of the Air Force. I should put that caveat in.
Yeah, of course.
But there is some pushback in terms of, if not hostility to security cooperation, at least some skepticism about it. I was wondering if you could walk us through some of the reasons why security cooperation can be kind of a controversial topic in military circles.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of pushback on the idea, and a lot of it has to do with performance in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria. You know, without a doubt, we could use the F word, failure, in certain places. You see the restart. And so I think there's about 3 million veterans now of Iraq and Afghanistan. So their impressions of building the partners' capacity are really based on their personal experience. Whereas, as we all know, it's dissatisfying. At this point, the Iraqis should have had the capability to deal with the emergence of ISIS and bringing regional stability. The Afghans are taking greater casualties today than they were 5 years ago, in spite of, $100 billion effort to build their force. Huge setbacks in that way. What I usually sort of try to highlight, too, so we have those experiences and then some positive experiences. So if we want to compare industrial scale efforts, so Afghanistan, I would also raise, how about South Korea? Because that was a rebuild effort from scratch in the 1950s, and South Korean military today is fantastic. If we look at a more recent example, smaller scale effort, Colombia, Plan Colombia, for example, which begins in the early 2000s. And so with a modest amount of U.S. personnel, Congress had capped it at 400 because of the Vietnam experience failure. The Colombians were able to take this modest personnel input and training in certain types of equipment, helicopters in particular, to build an air mobility command. And the Colombian military really brought their government from, I would say, the brink of failure back to a great, strong democratic capitalist country. But if we sort of look more broadly, I mean, one of the reasons failure is probably going to be more common is we're non-exclusive. That over the last 15 years, we had 40 status of forces agreements, or SOFAs, in the year 2000. Today, it tripled to about 120. If we look at funding for military education and training, IMET, it's doubled. Foreign military financing, where you can use U.S. grants to buy equipment, it's more than doubled. We're extremely non-exclusive. And any time you take the non-exclusive approach and plant, 1,000 seeds, you're not always going to get flowers everywhere. So there probably are going to be more failures than successes. Sort of the answer to my critics on this point is it's a foreign policy program. I know we want to measure outcomes based on what we think we're doing. But, of course, there's an effort to make armies, air forces, and navies better. But there is a foreign policy dimension to this that we can't overlook. And sometimes what that means is we get a better relationship. The U.S. gets base access, and in some cases, there are clear cooperative benefits, such as working with Japan and Israel on missile defense. That's security cooperation too. It's not just Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan. Security cooperation is Israel, is South Korea, is Japan, is India, and we can't overlook those things too.
So you've outlined why you think it's important, answered some of the criticisms about, sort of skepticism about the mission. But how then do you reconcile what is actually, I think, a broader kind of policy debate that happened at least briefly during the last presidential election about the role of the military? There was, you know, discussion back and forth between different political leaders about, I think there was a quote at one point saying that the military's job is to break stuff and that it should only be basically kinetic missions and then sort of, you know, tug and pull back and forth on that. So how does then the military, which is already pretty overstretched with its current obligations, balance the kinetic mission with the security cooperation mission?
Yeah, it's and this is sort of an old idea. I mean, one of the inspirations for me was Marine General Krulak and his experience in Somalia in the early 90s. He talked about the three-block war, where at any one time a Marine unit would be fighting, providing peacekeeping, and conducting humanitarian assistance all at the same time. And it very much, this is an important debate. I mean, I get pushback, you know, on both sides from the humanitarian community that says you're militarizing foreign policy. This should be the work of NGOs, not military personnel. And my response usually is, I agree absolutely, and that's the preferred outcome. But in certain spaces where it's too dangerous for NGOs to operate, like Iraq, Afghanistan, you do find that the military is operating in those spaces. From the military, I get sort of that same sort of criticism is, look, the military's role is to fight and win the nation's wars, kill people, break things. And then I'll usually highlight, as you know, the military is largely a logistics force. And so I think in the Army, for example, it's about a 1-to-6 ratio, one sort of lethal trigger puller to six support. And so how I see security cooperation and these other things is, well, what are those six guys? What are those six people doing when they're not fighting war? That the U.S. military here has the largest logistics capability in the world. The U.S. military has the largest deployable medical system in the world. And so when President Obama, for example, wants to respond to the Ebola crisis, he looked to the U.S. military because it could bring its own logistics, medical capability to help countries overcome the security deficit created by Ebola. It's without a doubt it's controversial, but it's also sort of how you conceptualize war. I mean, I would say the kind of work that I've been doing is how do you prevent conflict? And you prevent conflict, I think, through strength and through partnership. My refrain often is Switzerland flies the F-18, for example. They have about 30 F-18 Hornets. More fighter aircraft than Nigeria does. And I think we would say countries need a minimum level of national security, both from a defense perspective to protect their airspace, but also sort of the internal perspective, which is really dealing more with policing. That's, I suppose, sort of the discussions that I often have. But it's very controversial. But I've been trying to sort of look more at cases where, you know, again, to look at how the Gulf Cooperation Council countries are responding to Iran, you know, for example. That's a security deficit. It's not all about training Afghans to drive cars or be better marksmen.
Gotcha. Well, I was wondering if you could walk us through a couple of other examples. You mentioned Ebola as an example of using the military's robust logistics capability to solve a pressing challenge. But I was wondering if you could walk us through any other case studies besides the Ebola case or Iraq and Afghanistan that really kind of capture and crystallize an example of where that logistics capability has really paid off for conducting these kind of missions.
Yeah, let me even try to navalize this a little bit in maritime. It's
we are a maritime security podcast.
We are, So I apologize. Going, you know, again, it's the, you know, with some irony, I'm in the Navy Reserves, and two times I've been mobilized. I ended up working for the Army, so I probably have more insights, in the Army. But the Navy is extremely embedded in the concept of security cooperation. And so, for example, in the book I reference in 2005, two thinkers, Admiral Morgan and Admiral Martolio, proposed this notion of the 1,000-ship Navy. And it wasn't a 1,000 U.S. flag warships, but it was the idea that the oceans are too big, there is too much maritime insecurity for one country alone to deal with this. So we need to sort of use the logistics capability, use the U.S. success in the intelligence field, and command and control to organize other countries to form maritime coalitions. And we see this today. There are three maritime coalitions operating in out of Bahrain that are patrolling the Indian Ocean, the Arabian or Persian Gulf, and those important waterways and choke points, Strait of Hormuz, Bab el-Mandeb. That's security cooperation. It's countries that are coming together, working together to reduce security deficits at sea. That's on the maritime front. On the positive, where it sort of pays off, is we saw it was about a year and a half ago that the U.S. had an aircraft carrier gap in the region. And so France, for example, assumed command of the CTF-50 and used the Charles de Gaulle, its aircraft carrier, to be the lead strike element. That was possible because the U.S. and French and other navies of the region had been exercising together and promoting interoperability. And that's something where the U.S. benefits along those lines. And you look at bilats in Northeast Asia, you know, for every F-35 that the Japanese and Koreans buy, it's one more in-theater the U.S. could have in time of crisis, or you could argue maybe one less the U.S. would need in-theater because we fight in a coalition way. Coalition warfare is the norm, and we need to promote that through that interoperability and information sharing.
So you mentioned 1,000-ship Navy. I'm glad we're getting to the Navy and the maritime dimension of this. So 1,000-ship Navy, maritime coalitions. But during the maritime chapter in your book, you talk about some things and some key pressing issues that most people probably don't think of when they think of the sea services. You talk about illegal fishing, piracy, trafficking, and pollution. So I'm curious what makes the maritime domain different then for conducting security cooperation versus things that happen on the land or in the air? And then how do those particular issues that you identify play into the Navy and the Coast Guard's capabilities for dealing with these challenges?
Yeah, I think in general, I'm united about the idea of just security deficits and whether the security deficits are on land, in the air, or at sea. But the idea of the security deficit is a country lacks the ability to protect its national security without others' help. And in this case, other tends to be the United States because we're largest military in the world, at least by dollar-wise, very professional. The U.S. has no shortage of soft power that almost every country in the world wants U.S. attention. And that's sort of a sign of the strength of U.S. soft power. But how it works at sea, so the source of the insecurity is different. So in Latin America on the ground, I would say the source of the security deficit tends to be either transnational gangs or trafficking organizations. At sea in East Africa, you know, for example, it was maritime piracy. And so the deficit was on the land that the Somali government, you know, didn't exist and could not control its water space. And that created the deficit at sea that enabled the pirates, the maritime pirates, to challenge commercial shipping and conduct hijackings. Same thing with airspace. You know, we take for granted, I think, in the United States, we have a pretty good picture of what U.S. airspace is, aircraft comings and going. That's not true in many parts of the world. And so the U.S. will promote air understanding through exporting radars, building command and control networks to be able to help countries control their airspace. And we also have to be open-minded on sea that, you know, the U.S. military, U.S. Navy in particular, is, you know, focused on sea control and preparing for naval warfare. But the other 100 and more navies and coast guards in the world really aren't, that they're really concerned about migrant flow, illegal fishing, and maritime piracy. And so when the U.S. Navy wants to work with these countries, that's where they have to meet them. The U.S. has to meet these countries at what concerns them, not necessarily what concerns us. But I would also argue if we can figure out how to work together in combating maritime piracy, if there is a naval warfare scenario, then we can apply those same principles, command and control, information sharing, interoperability to a combat scenario.
So then let's go down a little bit further into that, because, you know, as you mentioned, a lot of countries' navies are function, you know, are more functionally like coast guards.
That's right. Yeah.
Interest. So then what do you see then as the balance or the proper roles of the Navy, the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Coast Guard for doing the security cooperation mission then? Is it something then that the Navy needs to be more, you know, adept at dealing with the kind of law enforcement issues, even though it's not allowed to do them on behalf of the U.S.? Or do you see the Coast Guard as needing to do a larger security cooperation role despite its smaller size? Like, what do you see then as the proper balance and the sort of role distribution for those organizations?
Yeah, I don't want to upset some of your listeners by using the gray zone concept, because I know it's controversial. But at least by U.S. law, we want to separate sort of war and police very cleanly. And so we'd say if it's law enforcement, the Coast Guard should do it. If it's war, the Navy should do it. And I agree sort of in principle. What I have found, you know, in my own sort of reading of history and then my own military experience is war and peace don't separate so neatly on the battlefield. And I would go back to sort of General Krulak's three-block war depiction. Because you know, what I sort of raise a question of, well, what about when a drug trafficking organization uses a semi-submersible vehicle? Is that really a police problem or is that a Navy problem? In general, the Coast Guard doesn't practice anti-submarine warfare. The Navy does. And so that's where I would sort of say, well, it really I suppose it really depends and sort of look at the concepts. Would I want the Coast Guard to develop an anti-submarine warfare capability? I would probably say no, just because it's sophisticated, it's time-consuming, it's expensive. But in the lack of submarines deploying, say, in the Western Hemisphere, would it make sense for the Navy to sort of build up during its workups to do ASW again, semi-submersible? I think I would be more open-minded, you know, along those lines. Is there a shortage of vessels out there, whether they're gray hull or white hull? Absolutely. And is there any amount that the U.S. can field in order to fill the gap? Absolutely not. And that's where I think the Global Maritime Partnership initiative and all the various approaches and new ways to describe that, I think, are incredibly important for U.S. national security.
One of the ways that you dive into in your book is the global fleet station concept. I was wondering if you could walk us through that. What is the global fleet station? How does it work? And how has it been utilized so far?
Yeah, this is a small-scale attempt for the Navy to work with other navies around the world. And so in Africa, the Global Fleet Station concept, Africa Partnership Station, there's a version in the Western Hemisphere, Southern Partnership Station. I think there's a Pacific version, Pacific Partnership Station. But the idea is it's a mobile training platform. And so the Navy will operate this and go from port to port. Spending, I would say, you know, a little time in each place because my criticism of it is it's a mobile platform. They're doing short courses. And in many cases, you're not going to be able to address any of the long-term challenges that these navies and coast guards have by providing a week's worth of training. And I don't think it's intended to do that. It's supposed to be one more way to supplement these programs. You know, if you remember at the start, I'm a professor. I'm a believer one learns most while teaching others. And so I think the sailors and Marines and Coast Guardsmen who embark foreign participants on these programs, they're teaching, but I think they're also learning as they're going through that process. And these programs, you know, you're starting to see, I mean, there's been some good efforts in West Africa by the Ghanaian and Nigerian navies to combat some armed robbery at sea activity, and that's coming through these training programs. But, you know, I would sort of start with, you know, being realistic about what the United States can do. If you sort of look at, you know, I've got a good friend who's down at Tulane, and he really sort of takes a more isolationist view of U.S. foreign policy. As we've got, you know, we're at a great point in our history. We've got a strong military, strong economy, oceans to protect us, safe neighbors. We should pull back. And he often quotes me because I say something like a superpower is not a superhero, that sometimes we believe our own hype in terms of we can accomplish anything. And if I can quote former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, not too long, but Secretary Carter said, we can give them training, we can give them equipment, We obviously can't give them the will to fight, but if we give them training, we give them equipment and give them support and give them some time, I hope they will have the will to fight. And so he was really saying this in context of Iraq as we restarted the programs under President Obama. But, you know, I would say that's more broadly true, is we can train, we can equip, but they need that will to fight. An external actor like the United States can only have so much influence.
Now, throughout the course of your research, obviously you've given a great detailed description of how the U.S. does the security cooperation mission. And you also mentioned that the United States, for the most part, is sort of the international partner of choice, whether because we're a superpower or just by default that we can be in more places because of our mastery of logistics. But I'm curious, in your research, have you come across other ways of doing the security cooperation mission that other countries have done, say, either what Japan is starting to do in Southeast Asia, or obviously the French are doing training and support missions in Mali, or the role of nations under the NATO banner in Afghanistan? Are there other security cooperation models that you've found interesting or noteworthy for our audience that you've seen from other countries?
I think in general, other countries tend to follow the U.S. model, but I would say the U.S. doesn't have a model. And this is one of the sources of criticism, that there is no one-size-fits-all approach to security cooperation in terms of how do you do it, how do you know it works. And I would kind of say that's sort of the right approach, is if, and I understand why people want to see measures of effectiveness and performance, and I kind of get that. But I think if you realize much of the funding flows through Title 22 or the Department of State International Assistance account, to remind everybody, it's a foreign policy program and not everything is going to be successful. In terms of other countries, I mean, you see, the Chinese, for example, they've replicated U.S. hospital ships that are doing some of these medical diplomacy missions. They've replicated the idea of U.S. war colleges and command and staff colleges to bring people to their countries to study, ironically, many of the same things that we study. But there's different models out there. We're seeing it. I didn't talk about too many successes, but of what I think a success might be. And so let me use another example. Let me use Canada. So this might get to the heart of your question. So Canada had been training Jamaican pilots, helicopter pilots, for decades. They would bring them up to Canada, very expensive. And so at one point, Canada said, we would like the Jamaicans to be self-sufficient on this. So Canada helped stand up a helicopter training program inside Jamaica. And so Jamaica could train its own pilots. But then what also happened is now Jamaica is a regional center to train pilots from throughout the Caribbean and Central America as well. And that, to me, is sort of a great idea, is put the training base in another country. And so maybe that's one sort of good lesson that we could learn, is build up other training capacities in other countries. And we've done that with peacekeeping centers. The other one, like Plan Colombia, you start to say, well, what does it look like when these countries graduate? Do these countries ever graduate? And I would say, well, remember, it's a foreign policy program. So I don't envision Israel ever graduating from U.S. security assistance programs. It's an important relationship. In some respects, it's a two-way relationship, especially on missile defense technology. But it's also a U.S. foreign policy priority to ensure Israel has the strongest military in the region. In the case of Colombia, though, what we've seen, their graduation, to me, is they're training now other militaries in the hemisphere against drug traffickers and insurgents. And so now you see Colombia sending advisors to Central America and to Mexico. You see Colombia training pilots and other special operations and intelligence in Colombia. And so to me, that's kind of great news, that the idea is that they've sort of – we still have a great relationship and long-term partnership with Colombia. But it's great to see that Colombia now is sort of spreading out and training others and working together along those lines to improve hemispheric security.
So if you were president for the day, or I even say king for a day, that you could actually, like, move the bureaucratic levers in certain directions, What would you do if you were in charge of making changes to the security cooperation mission that the United States does? Would there be personnel changes? Would you invest in certain types of technology? Would you put more resources or more attention into certain regions? What would be sort of like your wish list for what you would like the United States to do to improve security cooperation?
Yeah, I guess the first and foremost is preserve and strengthen the dual key approach. You know, one of the concerns that I think everyone has is militarizing foreign policy. But at least beginning with Secretary Gates and Clinton, they had this dual key approach that any program needs to be signed off by state and defense. So make sure that's preserved and strengthened. And but what I've found in working with different embassies around the world is ambassadors look at these programs as deliverables to their government. You know, as I went back, all countries have national security challenges. Switzerland even flies the F-18. And so we need to make sure we preserve that foreign policy dimension. The second thing I think is probably look long term. And, you know, we're on annual budgeting cycles if we're lucky. And so these programs take a long time to develop. And just like we know in our own military system, you know, it takes, you know, a decade or longer to get a senior NCO. It takes a decade or longer to get mid-grade officers. And so we need to be not such in a hurry and really sort of slow down. And I understand the fatigue that's associated with it. But, the standard, if we could go back in time in 2001 and tell our counterparts, hey, it's 2017, the U.S. is still trying to build the Afghan forces. How might you do things differently? And we might have tried things a little differently instead of doing, you know, a quick 18, 24-month approach that was tried in 2010 to 12, but think a little more long-term. And we're not very good at that. And then finally, you know, I guess I would sort of embrace, and I had to embrace this a bit because I spent time working with Afghan forces, is understand their failure is not our failure, and failure is okay. And one of the problems I think with sort of U.S. military culture is that can-do attitude, which works wonders most of the time, but I think with security cooperation and assistance programs, we need to make sure that the U.S. is not doing the work for others. That success is really when they can sort of stand on their own, and we're seeing it. I would say there's probably there strikes me as a little more patience going on today in Iraq, and if you look at sort of the General Votel's testimony that he gave to Congress in the last couple of weeks, we're moving at an Iraqi pace, and that I'm sure is frustrating for some who say if the U.S. did this we would be done by now, but the point is what happens after. ISIS is defeated. It's the Iraqis that are still there. It's their problem. And so they need to develop that experience, a skill, and invest in their own national security.
Well, I think that's a good point to start wrapping up our podcast. So again, as Sea Control tradition goes, let's talk a bit about what you're reading. What sort of things have been on your list recently? And for those people out there that are interested in learning more about security cooperation or kind of what's top of mind for you right now, what would you recommend they pick up and read?
Yeah, so I'm kind of at the end of a teaching term, so I'm reading a lot of student papers, but I was able to sort of find a break, and I picked up Nadia Shadlow's book, War in the Art of Governance. And I didn't intend to read it fully because I've got grading, but I really liked her book because I thought it was sort of the bookend of my work, where I'm sort of looking at phase zero pre-conflict U.S. military activities to strengthen other countries. What Nadia Shadlow in her book, War in the Art of Governance, does is she looks at sort of post-conflict and the important role that stability operations and building foreign forces after conflict play in U.S. military history. It's the war part we find is usually fast. And so if you sort of, you know, run through your memory, I think the U.S. captured Baghdad in about 3 weeks. Kabul was about 2 months. Desert Storm, of course, who we remember, was about 100 hour ground campaign, huge air campaign before that. But so what Nadia's work is really sort of looking at is, you know, I think two things. One, it's primarily an army study, but the stability ops are a critical part of U.S. Army history. And then I think her bigger sort of conclusions, which I find compelling, is we suffer from a denial syndrome, that we still have this notion that wars look like what we see on the History Channel with victory in the Pacific and sort of D-Day invasion. And we don't really have documentaries on, say, post-conflict reconstruction in Germany, Japan, South Korea, in the Balkans. And so I really find – so that's, I guess, kind of I guess the last book that I read on that. And beyond that, I don't know. I've got a couple of my own book projects that I'm working on, so I need to sort of I'm looking at the other side of this coin is what generates human insecurity. That if you look at conflict data, the idea that countries invade other countries is pretty rare in the world today. You know, certainly Russia, Ukraine, Georgia, U.S., Iraq, Afghanistan, Israel, Lebanon. But the idea that countries invade other countries is pretty rare. But there's a lot of conflict in the world that, you know, we're really worried about security below the state level called by subnational and transnational actors. And so that's what at least what I'm going to be working on next is looking at human security and how that generates responses then from U.S. foreign policy and defense strategy.
Wonderful. Well, I'll also take this opportunity to plug Exporting Security again on your behalf, because I'm personally a big fan of the security cooperation mission, and there's not a whole lot of scholarship out there that really tackles this topic. So I appreciate you writing that and sort of bringing voice to this sort of, you know, mission that flies under the radar. And thank you again very much for being on Sea Control today. Really appreciate it. Best of luck with your book projects, and hopefully we can get you back on to talk about your future research.
Yeah, no, Matt, thanks for your time, and you know, appreciate all the work you guys are doing with SimSec, and so keep promoting the importance of maritime security and the role the world's navies play in making sure we can drink coffee in the morning.
Very happy to do that, especially this early in the morning.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks.
That concludes episode 137 of the Sea Control Podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm Matt Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control. Special thanks to our guest this week, Derek Reveron, and our producer for this week, Ryan Yulia. If you enjoyed this podcast and you haven't already yet subscribed to Sea Control, please do. Subscribing gives you automatic access to all of our episodes immediately as they become available. And if you really like us, go on over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and tell all of your friends to tune in. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time on Sea Control.